Hello, and welcome to another episode of Unfrozen. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and today we are speaking to the Office of Uncertainty Research, a design research practice dedicated to rethinking architecture in terms of the emergent scientific, social, and political parameters of the 21st century. We have with us Mark Jarambek and Vikram Prakash. Mark is a professor of history and theory and architecture at MIT, and Vikram is a professor of architecture at the University of Washington. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about why we're here today. Earlier this year, you came out with a book called A House Deconstructed. And basically what it does is deconstruct piece by piece all the material and labor inputs into a single house, which was constructed in Seattle. And it's quite detailed and is sort of a jumping off point for all kinds of questions and explorations around sustainability and all the other things that we hold dear as progressive architects and adjacent architects. So let's first start with a question about what is the Office of Uncertainty Research and how does it differ from or relate to an ordinary architecture practice or your day jobs at universities?
Mark and I have been collaborating for decades now, and both of us are theorists and historians, and we all have been making grand claims for and against architecture in many different registers. And at some point we thought, well, why don't we make our own practice and put forth ideas in, built form, but conceptually, that talk about the things that we think are important and that need to be foregrounded. And so that's how it got going. We kicked around that idea for a little while, but then in the pandemic, we thought it was a perfect opportunity to start crystallizing some of the concepts that we are interested in. Mark may have a different perspective.
No, that's good. I would just add that basically we made this, in some sense, the closest model is to do something like a MArch thesis project. But instead of doing the MArch thesis project, you know, when you're in your mid-20s and we're sort of senior citizens in a way. I'm a little bit more senior than Vikram, so he may not quite want that name. We're tenured faculty members. We don't have to worry about production. We don't have to worry about, you know, pleasing anybody or saying the right things. So we gave ourselves these assignments, and basically it was something like 10 months for a project. We sort of said, okay, let's make a project. We blew sky it. So that'd be interesting. That would challenge us to in a particular way. And then let's give ourselves a clock. And then after 10 months or so, we move on to the next project. And so that way, in the span of, I think we've only been in business, so to speak, for 3 years, but we've already got 5 or 6 projects, 2 biennales. We're having lots of fun. You know, that's what we wanted to do.
And I add that it's a conceptual practice, you know, in a well-worn tradition that goes before, you know, people like John Haydock and so on, you know, many architects with academic footings have been doing that for a while. So I see this also in a certain lineage, but let's go on.
Well, it's certainly, the Office of Uncertainty Research is certainly the only sort of architectural practice I know that sounds like it could be the government front for a paranormal research firm in like a Marvel film. So it's one of the best names out there. But yeah, to dive in deeper, I mean, what was the impetus for the book? I mean, it conceptually reminds me of things like sort of like taken to its extreme previous explorations of granular examinations of certain places, like in pop literature, Nicholson Baker and some of his incredible work, but also reminded me of, in a way, of Gaston Bachelard's Poetics of Space, kind of, or even in a pop sense, Bill Bryson looking at rooms. Well, this idea of focusing on one particular, I'm assuming a nondescript house, and then basically, you know, doing powers, not powers of 10 as the Ames would do, but powers of 10 million, it feels like. But yeah, what gave you the impetus to focus on this particular house and to investigate this particular project?
Well, let me start because this house was done by an architect, I don't know, that Vikram knows. I'm not going to say at the moment who. So we had access to the house, and we had access to the architect, and we had access to the client base and things like that. So that was a big plus, because we first tried it with a colleague of mine, an architect, and I said, we want to do this research. And he got very nervous. You know, he thought it's not going to look good. So we then had to, you know, find an architect who was willing to undergo this type of scrutiny, which was a lesson really already on the first day. But so I'll just say that so to absolve Vikram of the problem of having to encounter his own, you know, world, you know, in that house. But yeah, it's a modern house. It's not exactly nondescript, but it's a generic in many respects, right? It's not trying to be fancy. It's not trying to be a millionaire house. It's just an addition, you know, to a house in a very crowded neighborhood, in a modern style. So it's, you know, sustainable, good design. It does all the right things that a small architectural firm would like to advertise itself as. And so it was the ideal scenario for us to take this house.
Yeah, and in some ways, that's a great reference to the powers of 10, because, you know, Ames's powers on 10 also goes to the scales of millions and millions to the power of minus, as you know. And we never really went down to the, you know, to the minuses. And that's a good point. Maybe the next book should be down to the minuses and go down to the quantum level. But that, I would say, I never thought about it, but I'm sure that was a subconscious reference for us, trying to see what are the sources of things. But having been said, I think we wanted to join the question of sustainability, right? And while there is a lot of number crunching, as we know from, you know, carbon footprint leads in around all the materials and assemblies that go into a building, we wanted to sort of offer our perspective on that as supplemental and in some ways critical to the normative in practice, and really take it to some other levels as well. So that was the impetus to add our bit towards this conversation, ongoing, really important conversation, of course, on what it is that goes into the making of a building, given that we are, our industry is so responsible for so much of the carbon.
Of course, the project, you know, goes into intense detail, and I'm really interested in finding out, you know, how did you get hold of the information and the traceability on some of these materials? Because I tried to do this in my own work with, you know, corporate buildings that, you know, have ESG responsibilities, et cetera. They have no idea in a lot of cases. It's very hard to get this information. So I'm curious about your tracing and tracking process.
Aha. Well, you're getting right to the nub of the problem. So some things were absolutely transparent, like the glass. We were able to find the company, we were able to find where it was manufactured, we were able to find, you know, practically even the truck drivers who delivered it. So the glass, because it's all done by robots, and they're very proud of, the company's very proud of itself. There was, I mean, to track how it goes from the sands in Wisconsin to the window in the house was relatively easy, because they were all very helpful, you know, in that. You know, the problem, of course, was the sand mining in Wisconsin has very important consequences for the people living around, because of the sand dust, right? There's also ecological consequences, because this is basically strip mining. They take off the first 6 feet of soil to get to the sand, which is some of the best sand for fracking in the world, because it's very rough. Then they mine this fracking sand and they throw away the rest of it. And the glass companies are sitting right there. Say, thank you very much. So all these glass companies move to Wisconsin, Minnesota area, where they get extremely cheap glass. They go into business, all robotic and so forth. So it, you know, it says, yes, we could figure out the answer. But then all of a sudden there was like, oh my God, the huge issues in Minnesota about the water running off, you know, from these mines and contaminating and leaching into the soil. And we never talk about it. You know, that's just completely invisible in our conversation. So there we had an actual, you know, a good example. Clearly, obviously, when we get to plastics, good luck, you know. So, you know, there we're just relying on more, you know, the scholar literature or our intuition and just filling in gaps, you know, so that we don't wind up only talking about the things we know. And the things that we don't know is also part of the conversation, you know. So, you know, Dan, as you said, it's so hard to find out, but that is not because it's hard to find out. It's because it's constructed to be hard to find out. You know, there's an actual social construction of invisibility that was part of our research.
That actually leads me to my next question too, which is you had sort of four, I think you call them vectors of analysis with which you approach this dissection of the house. So one was called atomic consciousness. There was production consciousness, labor consciousness, and source consciousness. I think we can sort of guess what most of those are, but maybe you can walk through it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we wanted to differentiate. It's the same thing, same material that can be sourced in or whose trail can be measured in different ways. The simplest way is, you know, what is officially recognized as the site of manufacture, right? So there's a map and there's a sort of a given source of where the place is manufactured. And very often that's a key criteria in thinking about the local production of things or imported production of things. So that was one vector. The second, we tried to say, well, however, you know, nothing is quite so simple and straightforward. Everything is amalgam of many things. And the sources of things can be complicated. And as Mark just outlined many times, you can't even trace where the sources are, like the plastics, for instance. The oil and what refinery and what oil is mixed with what oil and then what happens, it's impossible to know. Or even steel, you know. A lot of steel is recycled, and we're very happy it's recycled, and we brand it as recycled. But actually, recycling therefore completely muddles the sources of things, because you know, all kind of steel is being mixed with one and the other. A lot of it is, you know, comes from Australia, but then you know it's mixed in with all these other elements. So it becomes very. So we wanted to, you know, unpack that simple. So on the, whereas on the north, the upper axis, we had the stated sites of manufacture. Then on the right axis, we had the vast complication of where things come from, which becomes, which you know, in, produces that level of disturbance and distortion in the sites of manufacture, the question of manufacture. And then the third axis was, you know, obviously, what are the labors involved in that? Once we start looking at the labors, then you would think that that would be simpler, but actually that's also an extremely complicated question because you can't really tell what is the sort of percentage labors in large manufacturing units. And then as you go further and get more and more to the sites of origin, then not only is labor, you know, as Mark said, questionable about what kind of labor goes into the production of things, such as sustainably sourced woods, for instance, coming out of Indonesia, Brazil, so on and so forth, but labeled as coming out of Germany. So there are those complications of labor, but then there is also the complications what are the types and what are the sort of distant reaches of labors. And how do they come together and how might one sort of create a map out of that? So we wanted in those three registers to say that these questions are important, but extremely difficult to know. And in that difficulty often is obfuscation where some of the more questionable practices may be hidden. And then on the fourth is the atomic consciousness.
We get to the fourth, which is the most fun, but I'll let you do that. I just want to get to the consciousness, why we use consciousness, as opposed to, let's say, research or history, because we wanted to, in order to understand these three, I mean, all of four of them too, that matter, you had to, in some sense, overcome the problem that the research will always be inadequate to the consciousness of the problem, right? So in other words, if you're conscious of labor as an issue, it's not just, you know, the guy who you know, makes the doors for you or the window detailing or lays the concrete, right? It goes back to the nature of industrial labor, back to the very core principle of capitalistic labor and so forth. So, which leaves complicated and often, you know, very traceless questions about how do we define our commitment and our critique of the building industry. So the consciousness is a part of why consciousness raising, right, in these dimensions. So, you know, it's not that concrete has consciousness, you know, as such, but we, and so even though you might in some cases think that is true, in which I would sort of speculate, yes, but we're trying to talk about a consciousness raising along these dimensions so that there's more capacity on our side as historians or critics or journalists or sort of, you know, to begin to look at this, right, and to fill in the necessary blanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now let's get to the...
That's right. And then so once you start traveling down these pathways, if you like, or archaeologies, or whatever is the term for it, it raises the question of, you know, when were things originally produced, right? And this is, one got to pick criteria for this. But whereas, you know, wood is probably, I don't know, maybe 40 years, maybe 100 years, or, you know, hopefully it's not 200-300 years old. Or 500 years old, maybe, hopefully we are not doing that. I don't, we didn't find any 500 year old woods in here, so but we did find, you know, 80 year old woods. So we know when the tree was grown, roughly speaking. We also wanted to underlie a critical fact, which is, you know, that all the metal, all the heavy metal on planet Earth, you know, is not, wasn't manufactured, wasn't, how did it get to Earth? And it got to the Earth because of the original supernovas from which our solar system was made. Now, this is a ordinary fact in astrophysics, and everybody knows about this, but we don't seem to recognize that there is this, if you want to call it distant, but it's not so distant, massive planetary, interplanetary, galactic fact around which we depend, with that we depend on for all the heavy metals on Earth. So that is also a kind of consciousness that is now, we thought, needs to be interlaced into this conversation of consciousnesses of materials, which is not quite so much present in, you know, architecture and building construction, although if you look at other disciplines, planetarity, this kind of planetary thinking, particularly in the environmental sciences and places and people like Donna Haraway and others, they constantly talk about this in thinking about our place on Earth in the long time cycles. So that is a kind of a consciousness that I think needs to have a much more prominent, that we think we need to have a much more prominent place in the discourses of architectural thinking. And we were hoping to, through this process, and join the conversations in some of the other disciplines that are already present.
I'm curious about where you think the elements of obfuscation are strongest, or they're the greatest barriers that exist to sourcing, and where they might be, A, owing to the complexity of whatever the level of source is, or B, some kind of deliberate obfuscation. Where do you think the different aspects rank in terms of that? So, I mean, for example, I would assume that someone who produces fossil fuels might try to obfuscate the source, or at least the polluting potential of those fuels and their downstream products. But I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at.
Yes, yes. I mean, there are many layers, you know, of that. Partially the industry does obfuscate, you know. It doesn't want you to know, right? So the flooring, right, is sustainable flooring, but we'd prove without any doubt that it was, you know, not sustainable. I mean, you know, it was shipped around the world and this and that. I mean, my God, you know, if you call that sustainable, I don't know what is, you know. So that's, you know, not necessarily obfuscating, but actually downright, you know, misleading. And then there's proprietary information. You know, metal today has about 10 or 11 additives that make it stronger, more durable, do all the good things, quote unquote, for sustainable. But many of these additives are incredibly toxic and have done incredibly harmful things to the landscape in the mining. And, you know, you're just not going to find anything out about that, right? Unless there's a mine disaster in Peru or in Canada or wherever, or in the US, you know. And then all of a sudden you hear it then, right? So, but, you know, it's and this chemicalization is something that we discovered in our process in the last, I would say, 20 years or so. The building industry has become increasingly chemicalized through additives. You know, it's become more and more a chemistry problem than a building construction problem, you know. And we have absolutely no history of that. That's completely invisible in our understanding of how architecture is produced and discussed, you know, and this chemicalization is huge. And in many cases, it's celebrated as, you know, a way to make the buildings more sustainable or longer lasting. The metal on the house has an oil surfacing that makes it rust less and therefore doesn't require as much upkeep. And if you're building a house, that's sort of a good thing. But to put that surface on, the metal had to be shipped again halfway around the world. That particular oil, which is incredibly toxic, had to be laid out, you know, at 1.5 millimeter thick and so forth like that. So incredibly sophisticated machinery, you know, for all that. And the irony is this goes to just somebody's house. I mean, this isn't, you know, this isn't anymore luxury condominiums or luxury millionaire's house, right, who wants some special titanium stuff. I mean, these rather sophisticated productions are available in the domestic sphere as if it's like you're, you know, buying an Oreo cookie. It's not, you know, it's sort of like, what's wrong with that? You know, so that's part of our problem is that the normalization has been, you know, is in some sense the new normal of these technologies.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, what this starts to integrate into is that one of the problems is the general condition of modernity or the Anthropocene, which is that our entire industrial complex is so deeply interlaced with processes that are dependent that work via a kind of a exploitation of the planet. And this whole system is something that we will have to, at some point or the other, transcend or rethink is an idea that slowly, I think, is starting to get traction. And I think that this is an important idea because we, in all the technology programs, at least at my university, probably in others as well, you know, we are looking for ways to solve the problem, right? We constantly, well, if we do this, if we use this material or that material, if only everybody would use, you know, this kind of manufactured wood or whatever or the other. And we are trying to find a series of silver bullets to try and figure this out. But that site elides the general problem, which is that the entire industrial complex, as integrated with the capitalist infrastructure, is based on a system of the exploitation of the planet, which is something we need to fundamentally rethink. Or we will have to. We're going to be forced to sort of rethink that. And many places, many things. Jeremy Tell talks about architecture after architecture. It's an idea which I think is something that we need to start taking cognizance of.
It's interesting. As someone who relentlessly is bound to the practical, I'm curious your thoughts on efforts to try to sort of solve these paradoxes. I mean, obviously circularity gets floated, and this conversation is interesting for me. Just yesterday, I was chatting with a friend who works in prop tech, so looking at that whole dimension, and he specifically mentioned a firm that is using AI and machine vision to basically track every single source of supply that is delivered to a construction site explicitly to build a catalog of materials that were ever used in the project. So when it is time to deconstruct the site, they will know exactly, that's where we get into uncertainty, but exactly what has gone into that project. So it's sort of interesting, this idea of having absolute knowledge or surveying the actual process of construction in order to rethink how it will be taken apart. My friend and I were joking about the notion of like, that must be a great sell to real estate developers to know exactly like the scrap value of your building that you've just built for them kind of thing. But it is interesting to know that there are commercial interests that are trying to sort of approach these problems as well. And so I'm curious like how you think, the market is attempting to grapple with these issues of uncertainty of our built environment or how they might deal with it, or whether there's other conceptual approaches to it as well. I mean, beyond circularity, there's of course solarpunk and other degrowth and other approaches to think about some of these, extractive problems as well. But I don't know, there's a lot in there, but I am sort of curious whether you've sort of probed it, in terms of how others are sort of approaching this problem and trying to solve it, if it's, solvable in any sense.
That's an interesting question. I've never thought of how prompt architecture or AI might do this. I mean, it's
in this case, it's machine vision and more machine learning. So away from sort of the generative stuff over here and back to the more classical of just simply doing unsupervised learning of what's being delivered there and cataloging it. But yeah.
I mean, I think this AI project sounds really fabulous, and I support it because I think it actually can help figure some of that out. Bring into visibility this granularity that we're really interested in, right? We're trying to, in some sense, deconstruct the autonomy of architecture as a starting place for the conversation. Architecture should do this, architecture should do that. We're saying, let's first, get it down to, concrete, and then let's get it down to sand, and let's get it down to the sand mines, so that we don't ever lose sight of this incredible, on the good side, we don't lose sight of this incredible magic that architecture, constitutes, right? Which is all of this stuff comes together and you have a small firm building a house, with four workers and a couple computers, and a year and a half later, the house is done. And we have sort of also lost that feeling of the magic of all of these multiple things around of how successful we have been. But in that very success of mastering now the globe comes huge ethical, social, if not even political, problems that we just simply haven't even addressed, right? So sourcing is just one of those, right? The labor, I don't know how you're going to get AI ever to do that. Let's assume that's not going to happen, right? And the atomic consciousness is, you don't need AI for that. You just need atomic consciousness. You have to understand how important photosynthesis is, to make wood, and how important, the asteroids are to make steel and things like that, right? So our planetary history is completely on display, even to make a very banal house, right? So we're losing also some of that magic right there too, when we just dumb it down to 2x4s, you know, from Home Depot, right? So that, you know, is also part of our thing, is not just to critique, you know, the building industry, which I think is like 90% maybe of our project, but we also want to remind people that this magic has escalated. You know, my house from 1900, basically it's a wooden house with fieldstone foundations that it nails, or the steel is in nails in the heating elements and in the sewage pipes and the copper pipes and the hinges, right? So that's maybe at best 1% of the weight of the building. Whereas the house that we studied, well, I'm not exactly sure, you know, what it was off the top of my head, but it's, you know, not negligible anymore what the steel is, right? So these changes have not been incremental, right? The steelification, chemicalization have all taken place in the last 20 or 30 years, plastification, and they have expanded this reach and made the magic even more potent, but also basically put in front of us some serious ethical questions.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, that we launched today a mission to go to one of the planet, the metal asteroids, if you saw in the news. So this new era of extracting metals directly from the asteroids, or at least to determine that all this is true, starts over there. But I just, it occurred to me, as earlier we were talking about prompt architecture, you know, the thing about AI is that, as they say, that it figures out things via processes that we will never know, which is sort of, is internal to the systems of the machines. But it does produce product, and that in a sense is analogous, but not analogous. It mirrors what we are talking about, the building. You know, we get this product, what Mark's calling the magic. I'm trying to unpack that. I'm trying to connect the magic to AI, right? That to a significant extent, the building gets produced, but by processes that are somewhat unknowable. So it suggests to me, just thinking right now, that there is actually a pre-AI analog in the real world of how AI works. Just a thought. Just went through my head. You know, Mark calls it magic, but AI is the same magic in the sense that we think we know, have a sense of the outline of the process, but necessarily there is a sort of a mechanism in the process which is unknowable. So it's an interesting observation. I just never thought about connecting.
I'm glad we could help you with that revelation. And that seems like a whole other line of inquiry. Returning back a little bit to the dissection of the house, I wanted to know how you went about standardizing or normalizing comparisons. Did you use LCA software or any type of platform that processes environmental product declarations, et cetera?
No. It was such a mess that any attempt to standardize any of this would have gotten us into the rabbit holes of an analytic that would have been counterproductive to the message. You know, clearly we were looking at weight and tonnage and the carbon footprinting and all of this stuff. But, you know, part of our interest in the granularity was also trying to avoid some of the specific ideas about how we should measure this, right? That's why, once again, why we're saying we first have to establish a consciousness before we go off and into the scientific protocols. Because, you know, in, let's say, the labor consciousness, there could be 10, 20, 100 different ways to measure how labor, you know, is achieved. Now, all the way from the robotic labor, which destroys labor. I mean, if you think of human labor, I mean, you know. So the glass industry is completely robotic, and basically the entire factory that produces a third of the glass in the United States has five people working for it. So, you know, versus the man who made the spiral staircase in the house by hand out of steel in his workshop, you know, which was sort of a hand-built thing according to very specific dimensions, you know. So there you have, you know, how do you compare and contrast, you know, and how do you say, yeah, the hand-built steel staircase is wonderful, and we should support that compared to the robotics. But we're trying to not quite, you know, have a soft tooth, so to speak, for a sweet tooth just for labor, human labor, just because that's what it is. You know, there's a huge parts of the human labor invested in mining that is, you know, just god awful, and you know, we don't even know how to you know, talk about that. So I would say what we did as a strategy, pretty much at the outset, was try to not get too sucked into a one particular type of metric.
Yeah, no, we didn't use any. Sorry, I just want to come back to that point. And one of the reasons was, you know, I attend we have these faculty clusters in our university, various, you know, faculty groups. One of them, of course, is a technology group. And whenever I attend their colloquiums, one of their conversations always is about, well, my software, and your software, but their software, and sort of a lot of the conversations is about the complexities of the software and how they measure this versus they measure this versus they measure this versus they measure this. So this question of comparative that you are asking, I'm not a technology person. Mark is not a technology person. And so we weren't going to travel. A, we weren't going to travel down that road. And B, part of what we wanted to do was to kind of, from the history theory perspective, you know, produce a little bit of a critique of that and say, well, there are other questions that still remain unanswered and that don't get addressed when we go very quickly into the fantastic granularity that is produced by many of these softwares.
So it wasn't a case of trying to create a global numerical rating system or standard for the sustainability of construction.
Exactly not.
I mean, our quattro-partite graphing system was meant to be deployed on any house. And the idea was that you could take that and, you know, look at my house, any house, your house, and so forth like that, and then run comparativeness. So in other words, it wasn't about this one house getting a rating, but if we compare, let's say, my house or your house and that with a Seattle house, we can begin then to discuss certain things, you know. So let's say the ingredients list of this house was incredible. I mean, the type of chemicals that are needed to make a building these days, you know, just defies any kind of capacity to talk about them, you know, as in our training. Whereas the ingredients list of the house that I live in, because it was built in 1900, is, you know, probably a tenth, you know, of that, because there's no chemicals, no plastic, you know, there is now, but, you know, back then, no metal and all that type of stuff. So, you know, one can begin to sort of say, now, of course, we did look at, you know, the reason the oak flooring from that house went to Germany was because the oak flooring in, you could say, let's do local oak flooring from Arkansas. But the Arkansas oak was more expensive. So you could get sustainable flooring from Germany. Why are you going to buy more expensive from, you know, Arkansas? So, you know, that's sort of a client decision that would have to get made. And then we discovered that a lot of the oak coming out of Arkansas is called white oak, but is actually red oak, which isn't as, because you can't tell the difference, which is fast growth oak, sort of, basically, you know. So we're, you know, all of a sudden we discover these little vortexes. And, you know, that basically means each house will have its own stories. in a way, right? And because the sources will be, you know, a little bit different in each one. And we really were hoping that, you know, we could get 10 people to take this system, do 10 different houses, and then we could map and compare, and then we could begin to have a conversation about what we've been learning, because the cumulativeness of it all is what we're trying to get at. You know, not the critique of a particular building as such.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did the architects receive the information when it was finally collated? Did they express shock that their house was so less sustainable than they expected, or were they pleasantly surprised, or what was the reaction?
Not much of a reaction. You know, they consider this sort of obscure academic work and work within the parameters of the industry and go by the standards that they are used to. You know, it's this start to raise eyebrows on, you know, well, how do you really know a lot of these things that you're saying? So, but they were curiously interested, but not very interested.
That's right. We were glad that they were curiously interested. Our assumption is that the impact of this will not necessarily be about trained architects, because they're going to do around what they're going to do. But really, we're hoping that in the educational platform, in pedagogy, young architectural students could begin to think a little bit more expansively or deeper or more energetically about these questions than how I was trained, or how most of us in this room, I presumably, were trained, even, you know, with some sort of modernist idea that technology is good and the steel is good and, you know, all of those things, with zero level of rear view mirror. So if we can build in our pedagogies, you know, a generation of students who have a rear view mirror, then, you know, they can begin to ask the right questions and make some better decisions.
Speaking of pedagogy, I was going to ask, were students involved in this project? It seems pretty labor intensive.
Yes, we ran a seminar one semester at MIT, and we had, you know, 12 or 15 students helping us with the research, that's for sure. And it was a learning experience for them, going out and interviewing contractors and, you know, figuring out, you know, where bromine comes from and magnesium sulfate is made how, you know, and where, stuff like that. So they all, you know, I think were quite excited about this, because they'd never encountered anything quite like it before.
I can foresee this becoming something that maybe becomes not just part of the architect's curriculum, but a material science and environmental science curriculum, where the interconnectedness of materials, energy, labor, all have to be understood in order to make a series of decisions that results in, you know, the best possible outcome, which you know, is going to remain undefined as long as we don't practice this on every single building we construct.
You know, in our college, we have five disciplines: architecture, landscape, urban design and planning, construction management, and real estate. And for long, I've been trying to produce in the college a sense of how do you connect all of them? You know, we constantly do lip service to cross-disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity. But when we start to talk about building a shared consciousness across the disciplines, you know, very quickly the discussion devolves down to things like accreditation requirements and this and that and blah, 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 blah. And we find something at the edges like, okay, you can do two optional electives in another discipline or something, you know, nothing like that. The idea of the possibility of how we might share a consciousness across these clearly related, not only adjacent disciplines, it seems very very difficult to move. In many ways, it's because people just say, "Yeah, it's just not what I'm working on. I'm working on, you know, a traffic flows across the interstate highway, and I really don't know how I'm going to connect with you know, what you're doing in history theory. And fair enough. However, this book did capture the interest of a lot of people. They were like, what, really? You know, usually the books that I publish out there, they're like, oh, yeah, congratulations, thank you very much, and then move on. But this did, you know, my construction management colleagues, they were like, whoa, okay, this is kind of interesting. So I feel, you know, what Mark's talking about has legs, that this kind of a project is something that our can become a potentially a crucible in which, you know, these disciplines can say, well that's me, that's me. And then even our hope is it connects us to allied and adjacent disciplines, which we wouldn't think as allied and adjacent, such as the material sciences, for instance, really, you know, and engineering of various kinds. And talking pure physics kind of
discipline. In an ideal world, I would say that for Vikram and me at least, the map that we made in the Four Consciousness could become a small department, research department, all unto its own. You know, you could imagine if you have a bunch of students and a bunch of faculty working not on their pet projects and then being collected, but starting from this, then working out, you know, it would be absolutely incredible what would come out. You know, we were sort of like ants trying to describe a mountain, you know, and we all know that the mountain is out there, but we're never like look at it, you know, or think about it or figure out what it is, right? And we're trying to challenge the academic world to say, listen, there's just all of this stuff is out there. And it's not like bad. All of it is bad. It's just that, you know, every day we talk about ethical choices and doing the right thing and all that type of stuff. But then we need something like this in order to figure out that these ethical choices are in a thousandfold dimensions. Well, I guess we're not in a thousandfold dimension, but many four dimensions, but you know, or in a thousandfold, like an accordion, they just get bigger and bigger. And we need, in some sense, to get our arms around that project. This was just sort of like a, you know, throwing darts at it, you know, and trying to get somewhere, right? Open up a conversation.
Yeah, I mean, like all my colleagues who deal with the kind of softwares that you were talking about, I would love for them to, you know, come into this and say, oh, no, all your calculations over here are wrong. And, you know, here's how you would actually do it. And this diagram should have these seven more layers and, you know.
Well, one thing I should mention, too, before we sign off is, you know, listeners will not necessarily appreciate this, but this is a beautiful book in addition to being thought-provoking and informational. And I say that from an aesthetic standpoint. You know, the artwork on here is, you know, it's very, it's meaningful and representative, but it also is quite, it's reminiscent of abstract art, you know, something like Calder or Yves Tanguy or Jean Miro or something like that. It has this sort of diaphanousness that's really quite nice to look at. Who did the artwork on it and how did you arrive at that way of expressing the flows of material and labor?
It was a combined effort, I would say. We sort of had the general idea. Paul Monty, who's a graphic designer, was involved in the actual final layout. Angie Doer, one of our students that had just graduated, helped, you know, put the book together. So it was between Paul, Angie, Vikram, and me, and a bunch of others, we sort of figured out the aesthetic. But we, but I'm glad you point that out, because I think Vikram and I had a very keen interest in making this book look the way it did. That's for sure. You know.
Yeah, and of course, the original research was done for the Biennale, the Venice Biennale, not this past one, but the one before that. So that's how it started, and the main graphic was made. And then we, you know, given its success, we got very positive feedback from that. So then we decided to make it into a book. And I would just put in a plug over here and say, you know, well, A, buy the book, your listeners, but B, if you want to have a look at the main graphic, you know, it's on the website, officeofuncertaintyresearch.org. You probably put that in your, if you can put that in your show notes, et cetera, that would be great. You can
see it. I will certainly do that. And thank you for deconstructing the diagram, because I think that's a big part of it. For anyone who's imagining that this is just a bunch of tables and charts, it's something quite more than that. So thank you again so much, Mark and Vikram. This has been a fascinating conversation. It's A House Deconstructed from the Office of Uncertainty Research from Unfrozen. And thanks again, guys.
Been a pleasure, Daniel. Good luck.
Break apart.